Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. What happens when a MacArthur genius studies data from 72 million Facebook users? He proves something Mark Zuckerberg guessed back at Harvard when he wanted to join an exclusive final club.
I need to do something substantial in order to get the attention of the clubs.
Why?
Because they're exclusive and fun, and they lead to a better life.
Upward mobility comes from knowing people who have more money. Now, that, of course, was Jesse Eisenberg as Zuckerberg talking to Rooney Mara in 2010's The Social Network. Now, the researcher, Raj Chetty, the William A. Ackman Professor of Public Economics at Harvard University. He's also the director of Opportunity Insights, which uses big data to look at upward mobility for kids. Raj Chetty joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
I appreciate you joining us. So, is that a fair assessment that basically if you're looking at upward economic mobility, you find that if you have lower economic status, you do better if you associate with and know people who have more money?
Yeah, I think that's right, Tiziana. So what we find in the study is if you grow up in a community where low-income folks are interacting more with high-income folks, your chances of rising up in the income distribution out of poverty into the middle class and beyond is significantly higher.
Why?
So we think there might be a number of mechanisms at play, from how your aspirations are shaped. If you see folks whose parents are doctors or lawyers or scientists, maybe that makes you think about those careers. You get information on how to apply to college or things like that. And more generally, you might just get contacts that are useful in your own life, internships, job opportunities that you would otherwise not have had.
So it's both kind of, I know in sociology, there's this idea of future thinking. It helps you think about your future in a different way, but also maybe gives you pathways to that economic future that you don't have if you don't rub elbows that way.
I think that's right, Tiziana. You know, what we're able to say from the data so far is just that growing up in one of these connected communities really has a big impact. We haven't yet fully unpacked exactly why that is, but the various explanations you just mentioned, I think, are certainly likely to be part of the picture.
Okay, so now I have many questions, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about some of them. 72 million Facebook users. This is big data analysis. What about the quality and reliability of the Facebook data itself? Did you have qualms? Did you have to control for that?
Yeah, so, you know, when we started this project, just to step back a bit, people have been talking about ideas of social capital and how who you interact with might matter a lot, but nobody's really been able to measure on scale that kind of social interaction.
And when you say on scale, put that on scale.
And so on scale, I mean just, you know, using large data sets, looking across communities, across high schools, across colleges in America, we've never had that kind of information. Just because if you think about how you'd go about collecting it traditionally, you'd have to survey, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of people about who their friends are and how they're connected to them. And that would have been incredibly difficult. So what the Facebook data allow us to do is to take, as you said, a big data approach, just use the friends that people have on the Facebook platform to understand who they're interacting with and how that varies in each zip code in America and so forth.
Did you ever find, I mean, when one looks at the research, you know a lot about people. You can trace their friendships and contacts from the millions of users into the billions of relationships. Mm-hmm. You know about their friendships, et cetera. Did you ever think, I should not be able to know this much about people?
Yeah, so the data we're using is all privacy protected and anonymized. And what we're doing is creating aggregate statistics averaging over thousands of people. Now, it's incredibly powerful data for studying social policy questions like the ones we're interested in. 15 years ago, it would have been impossible to do that. As you mentioned, you know, you might have some worries about this sort of data in its quality. So, you know, are your Facebook friends really your friends who are influencing your life? Many people have 500 Facebook friends, for example. And so we're able to do lots of things with these data, like look at your closest friends, the people with whom you're interacting the most. And we show we get very similar findings if we use that subset of friends. So it is kind of incredible what we can learn from these data sets. And what we're trying to show is, without compromising privacy, without affecting any one individual, we're able to learn a lot that can help society.
So you actually produced two papers. out of this. And the one was the, you know, you need to know wealthier people. The other looked at kind of the quality and nature of friendships. I found that one interesting and in some ways disturbing a little bit, but maybe you can just give us the 30 seconds about this closely held friendships and how that affects upward mobility.
Yeah, so what we're finding in a nutshell in the first paper is who you're connected to in an area really seems strongly predictive of upward mobility above and beyond the resources in an area. So you might think, you know, if I grow up in a higher income neighborhood, I come into contact with more high income folks, but maybe it's just the fact that that neighborhood has more resources, better schools, better funding. That's what's leading to higher levels of upward mobility. And what we're seeing in these data is even if you take neighborhoods that have comparable levels of income, the ones where we're seeing more close interactions between low and high income folks are the places where kids in low-income families are rising up. Now, what we then do is ask, what is it that makes people connect more with people from different socioeconomic class in some areas relative to others? And what we find is that there are two different factors that really seem to matter. One is what you might think of as just the amount of integration or exposure. Are you attending the same schools as kids from higher-income families? Are you participating in the same churches, going to the same sports clubs, things like that. The other is what we call friending bias. Even when folks are in the same room, they might not interact with each other if they're from different backgrounds. And we find that that also is extremely important in explaining the social divide.
We're talking with Professor of Economics from Harvard University, Raj Chetty, about new research on social capital. Okay, so there's two things I want to pick up from there. One, we're not having this conversation in or about just any community. You know, you just talked about schools, for example. This is Boston. There's busing, right? There is a history of, I mean, the natural implication of your study would be the kinds of policy measures that Boston attempted in 1994. Let's go back a couple more decades. 74 with busing, it did not go well. I don't think anyone would argue, let's do more of that.
And that's right. And so I think what we're seeing in the study is we need to be careful about how we try to integrate schools or neighborhoods, because what you find in many circumstances is you might put different types of kids in the same building through busing, through changes in school district boundaries, but they don't actually end up interacting with each other. When we look at these data, we see lots of schools in Boston, and you can look up this data yourself in what we've released in the Social Capital Atlas. There are many schools in Boston that look very diverse, but they're segmented into separate groups if you look within the walls, where kids from low-income families and high-income families are really not interacting with each other.
So the other thing that I wanted to ask you about is reciprocity. In looking at the research and reading all the media reports on it, et cetera, it almost gets framed as low-income not desirable, high-income is desirable, all the benefits flow from the desirables to the less. That made me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think you raise a very good point. So our sense is that there may be benefits that flow the other way as well. In particular, there's some other research that's been done by a colleague of mine at Harvard, Gautam Rao, which shows that when high-income kids interact more with low-income kids, down the road, they are more likely to be charitable, more likely to volunteer, more likely to do things that I think many of us would aspire for our own kids, to kind of be helpful people to society in general.
Better people, maybe.
Better
a
people.
Bit. Yeah. What's the new research question that this opened up for you?
Well, I think the big question in our minds now is, if this matters, you know, social connection, integration, having people come together, how do we accomplish that? As you pointed out, earlier efforts like busing did not seem to be very successful. Well, so what is successful? And so we're trying to talk with folks on the ground, think about innovative programs that people are designing to create this kind of meaningful interaction, and hopefully study that systematically going forward to figure out how we might find policy solutions that could be implemented across the nation to create economic connectedness and ultimately improve economic mobility.
All right, Raj Chetty, thanks so much for joining us. Raj Chetty is the William A. Ackman Professor of Public Economics at Harvard University, a former MacArthur Fellow, and publisher of this new research on bridging social capital. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So one of the shout-outs given in the research is Inner City Weightlifting, which is a local nonprofit organization here in Boston. And we have two members of the Inner City Weightlifting community here with us in Studio 2 now. John Feynman is the founder and CEO, and Bobby Fullard is a trainer at Inner City Weightlifting and CEO and founder of a carpentry company called Bobby Builders. John, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Bobby, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
So, John, first, can you do the 30-second, this is what Inner City Weightlifting does?
Happy to. In short, we are a social justice organization leveraging the social enterprise of personal training to amplify the voice and agency of people in our program. People who have been most stigmatized by the judicial system without any search or acknowledgement of their context, circumstance, or humanity. And one of the ways we create economic mobility really centers on bridging social capital, flipping the power dynamics. Clients in our gym don't come to do something for someone. They come as they value someone as a fitness professional. And that leads to these really authentic relationships that start in the gym and oftentimes evolve outside the gym as well.
So you have created a community where people who have been targeted by the criminal justice system may have lived in low-income communities, may have been engaged in crime and gang activity, become personal trainers. You then connect those personal trainers to the folks that Raj Chetty's talking about in his research, right? And create both relationships that lead to money for the trainers and to hopefully change of mind and heart on both sides. Is that fair?
Exactly.
All right. So, Bobby, I'm going to turn to you because you're one of the people who trained and became a trainer. Yeah. Does that feel like John's talking about you when you hear it?
Yes. As you guys are talking, I'm sitting in myself. I'm the example of everything we're talking about. I come from low-income family. I come from a gang background. I come from that type of stuff. And it was hard for me to, like, bridge that gap between coming from where I come from and coming from people with high-income families. But, yes, I've now today, let's fast forward. I've been in the program since I was about 17. I'm 30 now, so that's like 13 years. It feels a lot different than...
How did you get to the program?
Friends. A couple of my friends, they knew about a gym where we can go and hang out, play video games. It didn't start off as like a training thing for me at all. It started off as to me, it was like a boys and girls club. I would come there. I just knew it was a safe place outside of my regular everyday
life.
And
you weren't safe outside in your regular?
No, not at all. I was a young dude gang banging, running, just doing stuff that I normally shouldn't have been doing at my age. That would have led me to having a totally different type of lifestyle that couldn't allow me to take buses, walk through my city, the city that I grew up in. I couldn't just freely walk through. So, you know, I would look for safer environments, which Inner City Weightlifting, came in so good, because I would still be back and forth in the streets. But when I would get out, back and forth into jail and home, sorry. But when I would get out, I always knew I had a home at ICW. If I didn't have any money and I knew I needed to work somewhere, I can go and train real fast and make some money. It was just always like that place, that safe haven. It's like a vacation from my everyday struggle.
So a couple more questions for you, and then I'll go back to John. Do you mind me asking, when was the last time that you were incarcerated?
6 years ago.
So you've been out for 6 years?
I've been out for 6 years.
And tell me what you're doing to earn your income now.
Oh, Jesus. I'm a personal trainer. I have my own carpentry company, Bobby Builders. I just started that about 18 months ago. And that's really where I'm at right now. I'm a really physical dude. I try to stay in my lane. I try to stay with personal training. And when that's not as hot, I'll do carpentry. So I just offset between the two. And like the connections, the people that I've met through ICW are most of my clients for as far as carpentry goes.
So we've just been talking with Bobby Fullard, who's a trainer at Inner City Weightlifting and founder and CEO of Bobby Builders. We also have with us John Feynman, who's founder and CEO of Inner City Weightlifting. We're having a conversation about some new social capital research that Harvard economist Raj Chetty did about the importance of connecting people with lower incomes to people with higher incomes for upward mobility. John, you value, as I understand it, a two-way street. So first, when you hear Bobby talk about his experience, do you think, yeah, that's what I was going for?
Yeah, I think yes and. You know, it's also the impact that Bobby is having on his clients, the impact that is happening on Bobby's family and the family of the clients.
Talk about the impact on the client. Yeah.
So, I guess starting with some of Raj's research, one of the things I really appreciated about was he talked about friendship. And friendship is a two-way street of influence and value. It's not about doing something for someone. It's about two people choosing to partner and invest in each other. And so jobs, helps them get a job, that's great, but jobs come and go. When you invest in each other, you get through the ups and downs together. You learn and grow together. And that's the kind of economic mobility that can be sustained. And so I think in one of the articles, they're talking about the magic of it. And to me, the real magic is not this change in one person or one person doing something for another. It's in two people changing together and really valuing the and honoring the agency and knowledge of the person closest to the problems. So when I think about the change in our clients, I think about seemingly simple but not so simple things like someone crossing the street to say hi to their trainer in the South End, something that would go against every social norm that exists.
Because of race, because of class, because of fear.
Exactly. And I think at the heart of it, that's really what social capital, when you bridge it, does, is that it disrupts this weaponized use of fear that we've used to justify unjustifiable actions like mass incarceration. Is when you know a person, you're not dealing with probabilities anymore. You're dealing with a certainty of what's happened to someone that you now care about. And that forces us to look in the mirror, question our own actions within these systems that we're all a part of, whether we like it or not. And so when that person crosses the street to say hi, and then he gets back, as he told me, and his wife asks him with surprise, how you knew that person. Now he explains, and now his wife asks the question, why am I not crossing the street?
Who's this guy that crosses the street? Paint him for me.
So this person was a director at a big tech company. And then moved on into working with a foundation and now actually is doing individual consulting.
And who did he cross the street to say hi to?
He crossed the street to say hi to Joe and several of Joe's friends. And the South End is this interesting area where when I first moved to Boston, I was specifically told don't cross a certain street. You know, don't go too far down West Newton. Don't cross Mass Ave on Tremont. Sadly, I even participate in that. I'm told this and then I tell other people to do that. It's not until I meet people that I realize I'm participating in systemic racism every time I say that. I'll never say it again. It's not to ignore people's realities, but cutting someone off, that's not a solution.
Bobby, so many nods. And you're pointing and you're nodding, so pick that back up.
Because it's the truth. Like, I say this all the time. Me, I'm like, right now I'm really calm, but when I'm outside and I'm moving, I can get really hyper and, like, really up. And, like, I run a lot. So when I'm running, you know, I got my head swinging, I'm sweating, I'm flying. And I like to run through Cambridge a lot. And depending on the people, if I'm running down the wrong street, I'll park the sidewalk like the Red Sea, like everyone.
So we should say for listeners, you're a black man.
I'm a black man with dreadlocks and tattoos everywhere. So if I'm running down the street and I'm a big guy, I have muscles, I probably look scary. If I'm charging down Memorial Drive, just running for a job, I swear I can literally park the entire sidewalk. Like, I can tap someone, hey, watch this, and then run and everyone will move. Which is crazy because I feel like, why? Like, what do I look scary? Like, what does scary look like? When I see scary, I see like a big monster with three eyes, four noses. I see something that looks scary. I look just like someone else, except I have longer hair, maybe rougher hair, with tattoos on my skin. And this happens a lot unless I'm running down the street and see a client. She'll come across the street. Hey, she'll stop me mid-run, run right up to me, hug me, sweaty and everything. And then it'll be like the whole sidewalk settled. Like, oh, he's not a bad guy. Why? Because this white lady came and hugged me and said hi to me. And hey, Bobby, you're running again. Yeah, I'm running again every day. Do it all the time. Yeah, it's good. You know, like, so like that. That's why I'm nodding my head when he's talking, because that's the God honest truth. And that was probably taught to the people who see me running, like, hey, a guy with dread scare, he may rob you or he may do something violent to you. Like, what makes you think that? Like, what would tell you that I'm gonna do something to you? Why are you moving out the street? Like, why are you doing that?
It strikes me too, and maybe I'll reveal a little bit of something about myself in asking this question, but I mean, so our bodies are really personal. Right? Mm-hmm. Our bodies are really personal. And what you're doing, John, what you're developing, and Bobby, what you're executing as a trainer, is having the power to affect and transform someone else's body. And often in these cases, John, I think one of your clients is like Microsoft, right?
Yep.
Often people who are very used to having all the control, right? Being the shot callers in every aspect of their socioeconomic world and life. And that is what's interesting, I think, in part about this intersection between the research that shows that the powerful wealth shot callers can do a lot to bring the Bobbies new opportunity.
Right.
But Bobby, when it comes to something intimate like that shot caller's body and what they want for themselves, you're the one.
Right.
You're the one with the power, the wisdom, the knowledge.
Right.
And John, that feels, I mean, I kind of have goosebumps on the back of my neck. That feels like that's just something.
Yeah, for a long time, we have pointed to bridging social capital, and I think that is really the key to it. It's you start to change, all of a sudden, you start to talk differently with your family. Start to talk differently with your social circle. All of a sudden, you start to reflect on the systems that we are participating in that now we are aware of, and now we have choice in our actions. And you know, I think about some of the conversations that have happened in the gym, but also some of the conversations I've heard from people talking not just about racism, but talking about the consequences of these specific actions individually and systemically of what racism has done in this country. And to me, that is just such a powerful dynamic that does not happen if you don't understand the people, if you're not close enough, like Brian Stevenson always talks about, if you're not proximate. And I think this is obviously outside of us, but that newer documentary on Lincoln's Dilemma, this might be one of the best anecdotes to the power of social capital. So that documentary talked about Lincoln not being the person who freed human beings who are enslaved. But in fact, the human beings who are enslaved and impacted by slavery were the people who evolved Lincoln and freed themselves. And so what is Lincoln's legacy if he doesn't listen to Frederick Douglass? What is Lincoln's legacy if he doesn't evolve from where he was prior to the Civil War to where he was by the end of it? That is a true value. I mean, we'll spend millions of dollars in this country on education, billions of dollars. We can talk to the expert if we just choose to cross the street and say hi and do it in an authentic way, because again, it's not about forced integration. It's about valuing each other and honoring each person's choice to also invest back in you.
So, Bobby, in the end, what we're talking about is mutual transformation.
Yeah.
That my last question to Raj Chetty was, my second to last question, you know, did you look at how benefit flowed the other way? And he talked about some hypotheses there. But we might almost be talking about a circular relationship, right? Bobby, pick it up.
Absolutely. It confused me at first when you guys said it, like, how does a low income, how does the high income benefit from the low? It kind of confused me, but it does, like Raj said, it like humbles them down somewhat. It more volunteer, you want to do more stuff out of the kindness of your heart. You may look at certain people now that you probably normally wouldn't speak to, but be like, hey, this guy kind of looks like my friend from that low income type of life. So I'm going to go and talk to him. Oh, wow, he is just like my friend. He's not a bad guy. So I do think it's both sides of it. I've gained so much from my friends that are on a higher end, but I know they've gained a lot from me. I know that. They've told me that they've gained stuff from me, humbleness from me, you know, ways of like survival, ways of doing things that they normally wouldn't do because they didn't have to. But, you know, they could be put in a situation where they would have to know it the way I know it, because I didn't come from what they come from. So I do think the benefit is on both sides. I honestly think, like, me being in a room with people from higher background, I'm exposed to so much more than low income. Like a low income, which is messed up as it may sound, low income people that come from that, they have a low income way of thinking. They send us to my mom. They put us in programs that like kind of won't help us out in real life. We're taught a lot of stuff that when you turn like 18, it's like, boom, go ahead. And then you got to just like literally try to figure out all the little things you were taught growing up, which 90% of it's wrong because, I can't really learn how to be successful from a group of people who aren't successful. Only thing I can really learn from them is from their mistakes. And that's what I try to take from the low-income backgrounds I come from. I try to learn from their mistakes and why they weren't successful. Not just follow their pathway and how they did it, because ultimately they didn't make it there. You know, so I try to, that's where I'm at with it. I know for a fact that it's on both sides of it, but I just truly think that if when I'm in a room with people that from higher backgrounds, I'm going to be greater.
All right. That is Bobby Fullard, who's a trainer at Inner City Weightlifting and founder and CEO of Bobby Builders. We've also had John Feynman, who's the founder and CEO of Inner City Weightlifting. Great to have you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
The Roomba robot vacuum changed the way many people clean and took some of our data along the way.
You know, I think that if you want the robot to clean the kitchen, it needs to know what the kitchen is.
So that was Colin Angle on Radio Boston back in 2018, justifying this crumbs about you for crumbs off the floor trade-off. Amazon is buying the Bedford-based maker of Roomba, iRobot, and Colin Angle founded it. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe, says that it's an acquisition with big implications for privacy, and we're going to talk about that now on this week's Tech Talk. Hey, Hiawatha.
Hey, glad to be here.
So do you own a Roomba?
No, I do not.
I just find it
easier to just grab the vacuum and give it a once over there. But they are really impressive devices. And I think it's important because, to the best of my knowledge, I'm pretty sure this is true, iRobot is the first company in the history of the world to make a robot that was embraced by the consumer audience. I mean, we've been looking at robots in science fiction movies for years. They were the first company to make one that people would actually go out and buy. There were about 40 million of these things sold all over the world. It's been an amazing success. They started out as a defense contractor making robots to look for mines and bombs. Hmm. And once they got into the Roomba, it turned out to be a vastly more lucrative business. And now Amazon wants a piece of it. And that's partly because of how the Roomba has changed. The original Roomba simply had an algorithm in it where you put it down and it would just roll around on the... Do you remember those old toys they used to have, like the fire truck that would hit something and then go off in another direction?
Yes,
that's
kind of bing, bing.
Exactly. That's what the original Roomba did. It hit something and then it moved in another direction and it was just smart enough to randomly move around and eventually cover the whole floor.
So for people who don't know this, it is a round thing about less than a foot tall that just sucks around on your floor in various directions while you do other things. All
exactly.
right, so that was the original, just kind
that
of
was the, original.
The fire truck bounce.
Right. But over time, they added more and more intelligence to it and sensors to it. And now what you have is a machine that rolls around your house and actually looks around. It sees what's in there. It's using cameras.
Why?
Well, because it wants to know the layout of your house. And it also wants to know whatever obstacles are in its way. I mean, I'm sure you saw the... What do they call it? I don't know if they want to use the word dog poop on this enlightened show. But their more recent versions are actually capable of recognizing a pile of animal droppings and steering around
and avoiding it.
Because earlier versions would go right through it and smear the stuff into the carpet. So they wanted to make it more intelligent. But in the process, the folks there realized that you could also use this as sort of like a surveillance platform for the entire house and a way to maybe keep tabs on all the other smart devices in the house. And so they built more and more intelligence into it. And so millions of people who own these things have a robot that basically has an internal map of your house and can detect when things are moved and can potentially figure out what kind of new furniture you might have in the home and so on.
Do you think, Hiawatha, that the 40 million purchasers of Roombas know that that level of intelligence and data gathering is happening, or do they just know that their floors get clean?
Well, I think they know because iRobot has made no secret of it. They brag about it. They say, yes, our device gets smarter and smarter and can figure out what's in your house. They're not hiding the fact that they're doing it. They also emphasize that this is very private data, that they're only using it to make the product work better and maybe ultimately integrate with other smart devices, but they are not sharing this information with others and they're not going to use it for anything, quote unquote, nefarious.
So I'm not going to see some movie where the thieves tap into the camera in a Roomba and use it to tour or case somebody's house for a layout before they go in and rob it.
Well, obviously, theoretically, that could happen if somebody hacked into, say, iRobot, so now Amazon's servers, they could get hold of that kind of data in theory, but the companies themselves are saying, that's not what we want to do, that's not what we plan to do. But clearly, this is something that Amazon was already interested in. As you know, they have already released their own robot. It doesn't do nearly as much as a Roomba. It just drives around your house, follows you around. You can use it what do they do? It can do facial recognition, for one thing. It can also control, for example, the Alexa system in your house, that you can have it playing music or whatever. It doesn't really seem to me to do a whole lot that people really need, but it costs $1,000.
Amazon Astro.
Yeah, Amazon Astro. By the way, they also have one. I haven't seen anybody use it yet. I don't know if they've actually got it for sale. They've developed a flying drone that flies around your house with a camera. Did you know that? They have one where...
I do not like that.
I think it's kind of cool. And this is what... No, because the idea is, if you have a security camera, wouldn't you like a security camera that could go anywhere in the house instead of having it in a fixed location? You could say, what's going on in the living room? I don't have a camera there. Go in there and look. That's what they were doing there. You could now do something like that with the
Roomba.
No, not just
with the
Roomba.
The Astro. Yeah.
You can do it with the Astro, and now you'd be able to do it with the Roomba.
So we've got this company built in Bedford, right? And Amazon now wants to buy it. If Amazon can already fly a drone around your house, if it's already got a robot that can follow you around, why does it want what Roomba's got?
Well, they already have the database that they've got of the millions of people who are already using Roombas. That's one thing. So that is a huge amount of intelligence about what's going on in millions of people's houses that they don't have to go out and get themselves anymore.
All the houses that don't have an Astro or a Droid.
Exactly. I mean, they've already got all that information. They've got the brilliant brains that developed it. Every time a company like this buys another company, a large part of what they want to buy are the brains. And now they've got the brains of the people who developed all that
stuff. And, of course, Amazon is saying that they intend to keep Colin Engel as the CEO.
Absolutely. And they're going to keep... It's not like when they bought Kiva, the warehouse robotics company, and they said, we're only going to sell these robots. We're only going to make these robots for ourselves. No, this is a consumer products company, so they're going to keep right on selling these into the market, and they're going to keep competing with companies like, I mentioned this, Ninja Shark, which is owned in Hong Kong, based here in Needham. And they, Amazon has been for years with this huge legal battle trying to drive them out of business, claiming that Ninja Shark has violated their patents, and they've lost in court every time. But now they're asking the International Trade Commission to ban Ninja Shark vacuums, and that's probably going to fail too because they keep losing the patent suits.
So will this Amazon purchase of iRobot raise eyebrows? Are we looking? You've talked about antitrust concerns, privacy concerns, so disturb me a little
bit. I don't know if it's disturbing. I mean, personally, I don't find this a terrifying thought, except to the extent that I get, and this is already happening, companies gathering more and more of our data. The most disturbing thing potentially is it's now more consolidated because Amazon, which already knows a huge amount about us, will now have even more information about the specific universe of people who buy Roombas. And by the way, they're all around the world. They're not just here in the U.S. But the other thing is the current attitude toward antitrust is shifting radically under the Biden administration. Traditionally in the United States, the attitude has been, if it's not harming consumers, what are you worried about? Let them do it. Now they're more of the attitude is bigness is a suspicious thing in and of itself. And any acquisition made by one of these really big companies falls under extreme scrutiny. And we saw it the week before this got announced with Facebook or Meta. We got to call them Meta. That's the company that owns Facebook. About a week before, late last year, Meta announced they were going to buy some little software company that writes software for their VR goggles, the Oculus.
Virtual reality goggles.
They're virtual reality goggles. This is a company called Within, and they make software for it. By Meta standards, this is such a small transaction, they didn't even tell us how much they're spending. It's believed to be around $400 million. 2 weeks ago, the FTC said, no, we're going to stop you
federal
from buying
Trade Commission?
The Federal, I'm sorry, I'm
That's
doing
right.
it again. The Federal Trade Commission said, we're going to sue you and stop you from buying this little company. And they said, we're not going to let you buy your way to control of the virtual reality market, even though this market is in its infancy. Even so, the FTC doesn't want that to happen.
Well, in Amazon, I mean, we're talking about insider intelligence says 40% of e-commerce sales are Amazon's in 2021. So this
is
a big company.
It's a big company. It's nowhere near monopoly. People forget, on the other hand, was like 15-16% of all retail is e-commerce. So the fact is that while they are gigantic, Amazon is nothing like a genuine monopoly. And also, this is a business that doesn't seem to impinge on anything they're doing. They're not knocking another business out of the business. They're just taking it over and running it themselves. By traditional antitrust standards, people would look at this and go, eh. But there's a distinct possibility that under the new way of thinking about antitrust, the FTC or the Justice Department might say, I don't know. and we'll just have to wait and see.
All right. So the other thing that was interesting to me about this is you kind of flagging that we have these big tech companies gobbling up local innovation.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's been going on forever, and it's exhausting. You know, think of all the companies that used to be based here that aren't anymore. The classic example being many people who are listening to this don't even remember Digital Equipment, which was one of the world's second largest computer company. They're long gone, and them and Data General and all the EMC was one of the last ones to fall, the world's biggest maker of enterprise storage gear. They got bought by Dell years ago. And it is this question that people have been asking themselves for decades now. Many of the greatest innovations in technology are developed right in this area. They're just routinely being invented. And the companies that end up prospering from them all too often end up being run or acquired by outside companies. And I'm not really sure why it keeps happening and why we never seem to quite get a critical mass and have it stay here. But it's a very frustrating thing in some ways to see all the Googles and the Facebooks and all these other companies end up on the West Coast.
So is this purchase of iRobot, Bedford-based iRobot, likely to go through, do you think?
I just don't know. I mean, under any other circumstances, I'd say sure. But under this administration, I'm not sure. I just would want to sit back, wait and see.
All right. Before we let you go, you have a book, Power in the Blood.
Yeah.
Tell me how it is, how it's going, and what you love most about writing fiction.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a novel about a journalist who actually goes to church and an unbeliever who comes to his church to help tutor kids in computers finds herself stabbed almost to death, and he is trying to figure out why it happened. And it turns out that, you know, she's an MIT computer science graduate who turns out to be working on a rather nefarious evil plot to
commit, dun, dun,
dun. Dun, 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 involving the global banking system. And he stumbles across this in an attempt to find out why this happened. And it's intended to be sort of a thriller, but it's also intended to look at the mind of this person who is a very cold-blooded and selfish person who nevertheless is trying to figure out how to be a good person despite his own innate heartlessness. And it's a character that I'm having a lot of fun with.
Oh, but that's fantastic.
And it's available at Amazon. It's called Power in the Blood. And I've been told it's pretty good. I mean, I got
there
a
you
few
go.
Decent reviews.
And there's Amazon again. Okay, that's Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe and our regular guest for Tech Talk. Hiawatha, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Let's welcome back now David Cash of the EPA. He's the administrator for the New England region, which is Region 1. David, welcome back.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So there's a lot that we could talk about, and we're mostly going to focus today on these things called forever chemicals, which are toxic even in little amounts, but basically don't go away and have been in a lot of products. Mm-hmm. Nonstick pans is one example.
Exactly.
Fireproofing sometimes. Okay. Yeah. But I want to ask you to start. Last time we talked to you, you just started the job. It was back in February.
Yeah.
These feel like a big deal, but you must have a lot of big deals on your plate. How big is the fire hose you're drinking from right now?
Actually, there's several fire hoses.
Oh, my.
That I'm drinking from, and it's all exciting. The Biden-Harris administration is moving really quickly on so many important issues that affect people's lives every day, whether it's climate change, environmental justice, water quality, air quality. How do we get clean school buses picking up kids in the morning so they're not breathing in diesel, big air regulation packages. I mean, we're moving on, I used to say all cylinders. We're moving on lots of batteries here.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know what the engine replacement
exactly.
for all, but yeah. All right, so that begs the question. We've got these forever chemicals. Yeah. The acronym that usually gets used is PFAS or PFAS. Why are we focusing on this thing that's measured in parts per trillion when you're talking about some of these massive issues? Tell me about this PFAS thing.
Well, public health and the health of our drinking water is a massive issue. It's how people interact with the environment every day. And our goal is that when you turn on your tap in the morning, when a family turns on their tap, they're not worried about the water that they're drinking. And so PFAS have been chemicals that have been around since the 1940s, as you mentioned. They have productive uses in products, whether it's in water-resistant materials or stain-proofed carpets or in firefighting materials, right? So they've been used quite a lot, and it's exactly their qualities that are difficult to break down that make them these forever chemicals.
So how does something that made my pan not stick wind up being a threat to my drinking water?
Because many of these chemicals, whether they're post-production or through the manufacturing process, can get released into the environment and make it into groundwater, make it into the air, make it into soils. And so this was an issue that's been bubbling up for a long time. And the last administration, even in the face of mounting evidence, didn't focus on it. And when our new administrator came in, Michael Regan, he put PFAS at the top of our priority agenda. He created...
It is at the top.
It is. He created a council shortly after he came on board that had scientists and our top policymakers on it. We traveled around the country. We talked to our state stakeholders, industry, and basically came up with a roadmap, a strategic PFAS strategic roadmap. And that roadmap has three big pillars. One is on research, kind of answering the questions that you started out with. How did we get here? Where do these chemicals come from? What's the pathways that get them into our body? And if they are in our body, what kind of risks do we face? And we already know and are knowing more and more as the science progresses that there are can be health problems, whether it's to your immune system or to your hormonal system, developmental effects. There's some increased risks of different kinds of cancers. These are things that are becoming more and more obvious as we are devoting research into our science. So research is really critical here. The second pillar is on restricting. How do we keep the PFAS out of these water bodies, out of our air, out of our body bodies, exactly. And that's partly what I think prompted this discussion today is the new health advisories that the EPA has released. And that's exactly part of the whole process that EPA takes to work with our co-regulators in the state and in public utilities to keep PFAS out of our water. And then the third R is to remediate. That is where there is PFAS, where we do find it. How do we get rid of it? How do we clean it up? How do we dispose of it? So, for example, one of the proposed rules that EPA is working on right now is to categorize PFAS and its related compounds as a hazardous substance. And once that's done, then we can hold companies accountable to clean up when they've polluted our environment with PFAS.
So I really want to bring that home. And we're speaking with David Cash, who's the regional administrator for the EPA. We're talking about these forever chemicals, PFAS. So as of January 2021, there were 127 public water systems in Massachusetts alone that had reported problematic PFAS levels. So this is, in this case of this reporting, 20 parts per trillion. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the new guidelines from the EPA break down. So there's several thousand of these PFAS chemicals. Mm-hmm. There's two that the EPA is tracking. One is called PFOA and one is called PFOS. And yes, I did have to practice those before the show. And now you guys are saying 0.04, 0.02 parts per trillion.
Nearly zero.
So
it's safe.
But it's everywhere. 127 water systems, right? This is deeply disturbing stuff, David. And how do you even measure 0.02 parts per trillion?
Yeah, for some of these, it's going to be below what we can track, although science is advancing very quickly on this. And, you know, you express this as a huge risk, which is exactly why EPA needs to be taking it on now.
And let me just correct myself, 0.002.
Two, that's right, yes.
I got excited by the zeros.
It's a very small number, and that's a cause for concern. It's a concern that we should have. So basically what the health advisories do is they provide drinking water system operators, states, our tribal partners, municipal officials with the scientific information that they need on health risks, so that they can consider whether or not action is needed. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones responsible. This, as I mentioned, the health advisories are the first step toward actual standards. We don't have yet standards. Some states do. The New England states actually have been leaders across the country in setting standards and monitoring and figuring out how big the PFAS problem is.
At one point, Massachusetts' standard was more strict than the EPA advisory level.
That is correct. And now our advisory is more strict. And we don't know where the standard will come out on. The health advisory focuses only on health impacts. Once we go to setting a standard, we take into account technical feasibility, costs, things like that. But it's going to be low.
So, David, what about if a listener wants to say, excuse me, Mr. David Cash, can I drink my water?
Yeah. So, the first question is to check with your public water utility.
So the answer might be no.
The answer, well, my guess is they would have heard from their utility if there was a major problem. And the utility would be doing upgrades and figuring out what kind of technology to put in place. And, you know, a fourth part, remember I mentioned those three parts.
There's a research, restrict, and remediate.
Yeah. A fourth part is billions of dollars that is coming in through the bipartisan infrastructure law that was passed in November. We've announced that at least in this year, $1 billion of 10 total billion over the next 5 years is going to go to small and disadvantaged communities so that they can invest in new technologies, filtering technologies, perhaps switching to a new water source. So, you know, we're combining the advisory with both the technical tools from EPA and revenue sources so that these utilities can invest in protecting their customers.
And of these 127 as of 2021 in Massachusetts, for example, is a disproportionate number of those, are a disproportionate number of those disadvantaged communities?
That I don't know. We'd have to check with MassDEP on that. But I know that our staffs are working closely with our state partners on trying to identify how we can best leverage these funds so they can go to the communities that most deserve them. And, you know, we work really closely. A lot of people don't know and don't need to know the kind of bureaucracy of how a large federal agency works. But at the core of how EPA was structured in the 1970s and through today is as co-regulators with our state partners. I meet regularly with the commissioners from all the six states in New England. I meet regularly with the tribal leaders from our 10 federally recognized tribes. And there has not been a meeting that has not gone by without talking about PFAS. How we can work together. What are our strategies? How can we help federal investments hit the priorities that these utilities are looking for?
So in our remaining time, I want to ask a couple of broader questions.
Sure.
And one is your reactions as an administrator to the Supreme Court ruling that rolled back EPA power.
It's a bump in the road. There's so much on our plate that EPA is moving forward with in our air regs, in our climate change regs, in the investments that we're making through the bipartisan infrastructure law. So we have a lot of tools that we're planning to use, all obviously focusing on what our legal authority is and staying within the restrictions that the Supreme Court has put down.
All right. So the second question, you might have noticed that we're having some wonderfully cool weather after some pretty serious heat waves.
I have noticed.
What's sort of the EPA lens on the heat waves? And is there anything particular in them you're working on, paying attention to, et cetera?
Yeah. So there are a couple of pieces. At the very high level, yet another indicator that climate change is already happening. These kinds of heat waves were predicted by climate scientists in their models, and now we're seeing them. So, you know, this is the reality now. On a more local level, whenever there are these heat waves, there always tends to be greater pollution events where we exceed some of our limits. And that's been true in New England in a variety of different places. And that's a huge concern because, again, those same areas are areas that have historically been overburdened by air pollution and underserved. And so we have a particular focus on how to address these kinds of, both through information, warnings, but also how we're focusing where we're investing EPA dollars and EPA resources to protect these communities. And I'll just give one example. Part of the bipartisan infrastructure law is going to go to clean school buses, electric school buses, and we're targeting disadvantaged communities to hit those dirty areas that have been overburdened. Because you should never stand on a street corner with your kid waiting for the school bus and worried what the kids are breathing in.
Mm.
So, you know, and we see spikes in asthma. We see spikes in emergency room visits when we have these hot days, not just because of the direct impact of heat, but because of the combined impact so that, a kid with asthma is going to be more likely to have an attack during those events.
All right. David Cash is the regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency Region 1, which includes Massachusetts. Been in the job since February. David, thanks for coming back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Good to have you. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with help from Bart Tachi. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Caleb Green ran the board today. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.